Voices from Jerusalem presents World Perfect by Rabbi Ken Spiro. Adapted and produced for audio by the Eisha Torah Media Center in Jerusalem. Have you ever wondered what the world would be like without Judaism and the Jewish people? Rabbi Ken Spiro, a graduate of Vassar College and Norwich University, takes you on a journey through history that will transform your understanding of Judaism and the four millennium mission of the Jews as a light unto nations. So the presentation is called World Perfect, and it has to do with the nature of the Jewish impact on civilization, which is a topic that virtually everyone I've met knows something about, but I can promise what you're going to hear today is information that you've never heard in your sixth grade, if you remember that far back, 10th grade world history classes. Everyone seems to say this is the vision of the way the world should be. And if you look at the list, we have a list of six ideal values. One is value of life. Everyone should have the right to life and to life with dignity. Number two is a world of peace and harmony, where there's no more war. The whole world gets along harmoniously forever. Number three is justice and equality, which is every human being should be treated equally before the law, regardless of race, creed, religion, sex, color, size, you name it. Number four is education and literacy, which is every human being should have the right to at least be functionally literate as a way for them to express themselves and to contribute meaningfully to society. Number five is family and family values, which is more of an institution than a value, but we all appreciate that without stable family, you cannot have stable society. That's the building blocks of society is family. And number six is really a huge topic, which in many ways includes everything else, which is social responsibility, people taking care of the world. Which is not just if it's taking care of the poor and the sick and the widow and the oppressed and the orphan and you name it. And we're talking about not just people, but animals, and not just animals, but the environment. It's a whole sweeping vision of every individual human being deciding to take responsibility for the world. Looks good? Okay, everyone likes the list. By the way, quick, take a look around the room. It's the only time you're going to see a room full of Jews agreeing on something. But the question is, I divide the presentation into two parts. Part one. If we all agree, and I say all, I mean basically this seems to be the utopian vision that all humanity has bought into, where does it come from? Has this something that throughout history people have felt is important? Is it the product of certain specific civilizations or groups of people? It seems to be, when people look at it, they seem to intellectually and emotionally, no one argues, they feel it's right. The question is, was that always the case? So the first section of the presentation, I want to go back in history. And history is great because it's the testing ground of ideas. Let's go back in history and let's look around the world to see, in fact, how did people relate to these ideas? Did they think they were great? Did they practice what they preached? Where are the source of the values? So obviously, to go to every single civilization that's lived since the dawn of civilization, we're talking about 6,000 years, we'd have to be here for about 6 years. There's no way we can go through every civilization and culture. So we have to jump around. Like skip, pick a few examples to illustrate. Now, that may sound a little unfair. How can you jump around and skip? But what I found in the very extensive research that I did was something very interesting. Cultures vary tremendously throughout history. How the Romans lived 2,000 years ago is dramatically different from how the Chinese lived 2,000 years ago, but how they related to this specific list of values is remarkably similar. You don't find any huge differences in the world. Everything's more like variations on a theme. So if I pick an example from this part of the world and that part of the world, don't think for a minute that there was any somewhere else in some far corner of the world, usually people think in the Far East, there was some huge exception where people thought and acted remarkably different. There isn't. Whether we look in Africa or Asia or South and Central America or Europe, pretty much throughout history, especially in the ancient world, we find people's attitude towards these values is pretty much universal. Ah. So then who do I choose to focus on? We've got to pick a few examples to illustrate. So I'm going to jump around a lot, but I chose to focus primarily on those civilizations which we as Westerners, not as Jews, we as Westerners credit with being the foundation civilizations of modern Western culture. What are those civilizations in the ancient world? We look at Rome and Greece. Rome and Greece specifically. Now, we appreciate, if you remember your world history, Greece 2,500 years ago, right? The golden age of Pericles, Athens. You had one of the most creative civilizations in human history. Much of, not just the West, the whole world's been affected, but much of our ideas about the aesthetic, the concept of beauty, philosophy, mathematics, empirical science come from one of the most creative, productive societies in human history, the ancient Greeks. and then Rome, which existed after Greece in history. But also, they not only spread much of the Greek ideas, but in terms of government, if you study law, Roman common law, any number of things, administration, engineering, empire building, much of the way the West functions is based on the Roman model. So we have two remarkably creative, productive civilizations which, multiculturalism aside, the reality of history is they contributed the lion's share to Western culture. And of course, they are the foundation of so much of the rest of our worldview today, and they certainly were the best examples of sophisticated, well-developed cultures. So we're going to focus primarily but not exclusively on them. Let's now go back in time. Let's run through our list item by item, and I want to bring up a number of examples to illustrate how people's attitudes in ancient history related vis-a-vis these values today. So here, I have some quotes here. If you go to the first idea on the board, which is our most fundamental value of life. Clearly, that is the most important. Obviously, if you are dead, education and, you know, literacy is kind of irrelevant. The right to be allowed to live and to be treated with dignity is the most fundamental right that we have come to expect in any civilization that we consider civilized in the world today. If you look at the ancient world, however, we see that the whole attitude towards right to life is remarkably different. One example that illustrates this very intensely. Does anyone know what the most common form of population control, universally practiced by every civilization we know of in the ancient world?
Infanticide,
very good. The killing of newborn babies is a ubiquitous practice in human history. Every civilization, with one little exception we'll see later, every single civilization did it. And newborns were killed not just as a means of population control, but more often, as a matter of fact, as a means of sex selection. Sorry, ladies, but in almost every civilization in history, men were valued and women were disposable. And as a means of ridding society of weaker, deformed members. A child born with even a minor birth defect or did not look healthy was left to die. And this wasn't done by the baby disposal squad. The parent, mother or father, immediately after birth, in most cases, would take the child, throw it into a garbage dump, leave it on a rock to die of exposure, to be eaten by an animal, or drop it down a well. There's many other, I don't want to go into too many details, we just ate lunch. But universal practice, and it was not something that the lower classes did because they were, you know, not civilized, but the upper classes shunned. If you look at the writings in the ancient world, it is often talked about by some of the greatest minds. Look at quote number one. This is Aristotle from Politics, arguably one of the most influential minds in Western intellectual history. What does Aristotle say in quote number one? There must be a law that no imperfect or maimed child shall be brought up, and to avoid an excess of population, some children must be exposed, for a limit must be fixed to the population of the state. He's not saying, you know, I like killing babies. He's saying, you know, defective babies are a drain on society, overpopulation is dangerous, the easiest members to get rid of are newborns. Now, we even have evidence of this in Ashkelon, which is a city on the coast of Israel to the south of Tel Aviv. It was a Greek-Roman city 2,000 years ago. About 10 years ago, archaeologists found the skeletons of between 50 and 100 newborn infants dropped down the toilets by their parents immediately after birth. And they surmised that it was infanticide because they're all the same age, all newborns. Okay, and if you look at quote number six, this is from Biblical Archaeology Review. This is a Roman writing to his wife 2,000 years ago. Know that I am still in Alexandria, and I ask and beg of you to take good care of our baby son. And as soon as I receive payment, I will send it up to you. If you deliver of a child, if it is a boy, keep it. If it is a girl, discard it. Throw the baby out. Now, we today, you know, when I say we, I don't mean anyone personally in the room, but we're very desensitized to violence. Now, I saw some statistic, the average kid by a certain age, early teen, he's seen 18,000 murders on television, you know. One of the few things that still shocks us today is the thought of killing a defenseless newborn child. In the ancient world, it was considered totally normal and acceptable. You'd be sitting down with your friend to tea. You know, would you like milk or sugar? And I dumped my baby down the toilet this morning. And people, you know, today people go like, what? Back then it was like, oh, fine, how's the weather? Totally different attitude towards value of life. Another example, which is also very extreme, is killing people for religious reasons. Human sacrifice is another universal practice in the ancient world. Virtually every civilization did it. Some did it more than others. The Greeks and Romans, as a matter of fact, were not that big on killing people for religious reasons, but other civilizations lived for it practically. Some civilizations killed their own children. Okay, if you're looking at National Geographic recently, over the last 2 years, they have a series of articles of the Incas 500 years ago. The mountain gods are very important when you live in the Andes. They found on the peaks of all these mountains mummified remains of Inca children sacrificed by their, obviously given willingly by their parents as a sacrifice to the mountain gods. The funeral rites of virtually every world leader in the ancient world was accompanied by some form of human sacrifice. When Pharaoh died, they'd kill his servants and stick them in with them. Right? When the emperor of China died hundreds of thousands of years ago, they would behead prisoners, kill lots of people in honor of that. When Genghis Khan died in the 13th century, the great Mongol leader, he was buried with 40 virgins and 40 horses. I don't know which he had more fun with, but it shows you the kind of guy he was. Some people, either their own children, prisoners, slaves. The best example, by the way, are in fact the Aztecs who lived in what is today modern Mexico. If you've been to Mexico City, it is built over what used to be 500 years ago before the Spanish destroyed it, the Aztec seat of power. To the east of Mexico City is the Aztec city of the gods called Teotihuacan, which is laid out like a giant solar calendar. Very sophisticated civilization with a tremendous knowledge of mathematics and astronomy. They ruled over 6 million people 500 years ago. They went to war specifically for the purpose of bringing back human beings to sacrifice them. It was an intrinsic, basic, and fundamental part of their religious worship. They would take thousands of prisoners alive in battle, schlep them up these huge pyramids, which you can still see today in Teotihuacan, and rip their hearts out of them one after another while they were still alive. By the thousands, they believed that the blood stopped flowing, the world would cease to exist. Human sacrifice on a scale that is mind-boggling. The worst example, I say the best, but it's really the worst example of the different attitude towards human life is killing people for sport. Now today we have hockey fights, and we have, you know, Mike Tyson bites off Evander Holyfield's ear, and we have the American Gladiator, and we're all like, ugh. In the ancient world, that was kid stuff. Many cultures killed people as a form of entertainment. And there was no R, PG, G ratings, X, none of that. Okay, this was public entertainment. The best example happens to be the Romans themselves. In over 200 locations throughout their empire, wherever they conquered, they built stadiums. And in those stadiums, the best example, by the way, of one of their stadiums is in Rome itself. You've been to the Roman Forum on the Tiber River, which is the seat of Roman imperial power 2,000 years ago. They built what's called the Colosseum. Completed in the year 80, the Romans considered, and they were tremendous engineers, they considered this to be their ultimate feat of Roman engineering. It was a huge amphitheater. It seated 50,000 people. It had a roof that could go off and on it. 2,000 years ago, the world's first astrodome. The football field-sized stadium could be lowered mechanically and filled with water in 8 minutes. It's amazing, feat of engineering. Ships could sail through it, you know, take the water out, raise the floor, put in fake trees and rocks. What was it used for virtually every day? 50,000 for free, meaning no tickets, you have to buy a ticket, you got a free cushion to sit on, free meat, free wine, like going to Yankee Stadium, getting all the hot dogs and beer you can eat and drink. Every day the Romans would bring, the first act of the day, they brought animals from all over their empire and watched them slaughter each other, right? Lions and tigers and bears, oh my, right? The animal rights people would have gone berserk, but they would have been act number two, which was feeding people to animals. Okay. And by the way, in Rome, everything was law and order. You couldn't just throw anyone to the lions. You had to be convicted of a capital crime. But believe me, if the Romans were short victims for entertainment, they would condemn minor criminals to death. During the intermission, instead of commercials, they would publicly execute condemned prisoners, flaying their skin off of them, burning them alive, beheading them, torturing them. And of course, the main act in Rome, which was much bigger than any sporting event we have in the world today, maybe not as big as the World Cup, but otherwise, is gladiators. Which was prisoners or slaves who were trained to fight to the death. In the year 107, just one example, the Emperor Trajan had a huge tournament. Many, many, many days, 10,000 gladiators fought. They used to, Romans used to write about all the tournaments they had, right? What a great thing it was for their honor. If you sat through that tournament, you saw 5,000 human beings die. Okay, 5,000 people die. Children watching this also. They had huge fountains that sprayed perfume in the air so the spectators wouldn't vomit from all the smell of the blood. And the Romans didn't, by the way, didn't just use men. They used women, they used children, they used blind people, they used dwarves and midgets and anything for entertainment. The most sophisticated civilization in the ancient world, the most barbaric. I always say the Romans had a lot of chutzpah, calling everyone else barbarians. And by the way, there's a tremendous lesson in here. We often misunderstand. We think that the more technology, law and order, and culture a civilization has, the more moral there will be. Even law and order, there is no connection historically between those three things and how moral a society is. Rome had the best of all three and was incredibly brutal. What's the best example in the 20th century? Nazi Germany, technologically, culturally. What an advanced civilization. Look what they did. If history shows us anything, some of the most barbaric societies in the world are the most legally oriented. So anyway, the point is not that for every reason anyone can kill anyone anywhere. That's not true. You had law and order, you had control within society. But the point is, for any number of reasons, human beings, even children, were disposable. So this whole notion of that you have a right to life, that's a basic value which cannot be taken away from you, certainly does not exist in the ancient world. Now number two, peace and harmony. Clearly, by the way, what is the greatest waste of human life in history besides disease? War. Remember in the 1960s, you used to wear these little pins that said, war is not healthy for children and other living things. Today, we all want peace. But, you know, it's an obvious point how destructive war is. I remember I used to work as a DJ, and I used to play public service announcements. And one of the public service announcements we used to play was for disarmament. And it said, do you know there are 2,000 pounds of explosive force material for every man, woman, and child on Earth? They're not 2,000 pounds of food, and they're not 2,000 pounds of medicine. Now, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, that might have changed a little bit. But even if it's 1,000 pounds, one thing is for sure. Humanity spends far more resources making weapons to destroy ourselves than we do on doing positive with that technology. What would the world be like if all of that money and resources and scientific know-how was spent on making the world a better place? I mean, it's obvious the world would be a much better place, right? Just on that topic alone. Now, it's obvious to us today, we all want peace. Like, we're not so clever today. Like, people in the ancient world were stupid. We tend to think that, but it's not true. You notice you don't see Plato, Aristotle, Lao Tzu, Confucius running around the streets of New York today. Okay, people in the ancient world were very intelligent. But if they're so intelligent, and we today are so into peace as an ideal, we even have the United Nations, right? How come the history of humanity, the history of 6,000 years of human civilization, is unceasing warfare? Think about it. Why do you think people are constantly fighting? Why are people going to war? So the historians give three basic reasons. One is, we're not looking at a quote yet, wait, hold on. One is that the whole stigma about killing people was very different in the ancient world. If you can kill newborn babies and kill people for sport, killing in war, I mean, what's the big deal? War is even better than sport. You get to rape and pillage and build your empire. But more basically, what was the law of interaction of nations throughout human history, not just in the ancient world? Like, what's the law of the jungle? Right, survival of the fittest. The strong survive, the weak die. The lion is on top of the food chain because he eats everything else. He doesn't say to the zebra in the Serengeti, you had a rough day, you rest by the waterhole, I'll go chase the gazelles. Maybe a Jewish lion would, but he doesn't do it. He says, I catch you your lunch. Not to do that is a sign of weakness. It's not natural. This is how all nations always behave. Rome never said to any other country, I respect your territorial integrity. If Rome didn't conquer a place like Persia, it's because they couldn't physically conquer Persia. That's everyone everywhere. Okay? So it's strong survive, the weaker destroyed. And then the most basic level of all, who is glorified in not just the ancient world, but throughout history? Who is the hero? Where does the word hero come from? Remember, what great work of literature do we associate with heroic literature? The Iliad. Okay, the Greeks, this idea of heroic literature. The hero was, by definition, a warrior. Not just any warrior, but the person who killed the greatest and most opponents. Go read the Iliad again. It's one giant battle scene with occasional breaks for long speeches. It's incredible. And the Greeks read that not as Greek literature 101. They read this as Greek morality worldview 101. Basic text of how to be Greek. To be an officer and a gentleman has been a manly and proper position for human beings throughout history. Everyone's always killing everyone. That's how you get honor in this world while you're alive, and that's how you become immortal and you become a legend in the minds of other people for thousands of years after you're dead. Look at quote number three. This is Wallace E. Caldwell of Columbia University. He's talking about the Greeks and Romans, but this holds true for all cultures we know of. War, therefore, is in the mind of the poet the chief business of men from youth to age. But he regards it as the special flower of youth. The glorification of war, the glamour and glory of battle were subjects of the finest words and pictures. Any kind of peace you had in the ancient world, including what was called Pax Romana, Roman peace, was the break you took between wars to rearm. An idea of a permanent state of peace for all mankind, no more expansion, no empire, none of that stuff, is unknown in human history. So our great idea, number two value, peace and harmony, gone. It's not a reality in human history, in theory or in practice. Okay, justice and equality. So let me draw a little picture here. Let's just say here we have the masses of humanity that have lived throughout human history. Now today, when we look at the idea of justice and equality, this is certainly probably one of the most basic rights that we expect in any liberal democratic country. The right to fair trial by your peers or whatever country you live in. Equal treatment before the law. Now, we realize it doesn't always work that great. Look, you know, O.J. Simpson trial. I once saw a great cartoon of a guy sitting in an office and his lawyer says to him, "So, Mr. Smith, how much justice can you afford?" But, you know, okay, it's not a perfect system. No one said it was, but it's at least guaranteed in America by the Constitution and in England and you name it. But look back in history. So we hold justice and equality to be sacrosanct. But if you look in ancient history, at Joe Average person who lived in the world, where was Joe Average person in terms of the socioeconomic ladder in history? Upper, middle, low, the average person, what title would we give him? Low, peasant, serf. What's a peasant or a serf? And it's not just feudal Europe where you have this. Peasant, right? He's a pseudo-slave, more or less. Sometimes they're openly slaves. A lot of civilizations had massive numbers of slaves. In Russia, until 1861, the whole population was legally indentured slaves. I'm not talking about blacks in America. We're talking about Russian Slavs to the nobility. But in feudal Europe or feudal Japan or wherever you look in the world, you find Joe Average person is either a slave or a serf. A serf either owned a small piece of land, which he eked out a meager living on, and gave much of what he farmed to whom? The lord, right on top. The nobleman, will give him an inn. Or sometimes he was like a sharecropper, didn't even own the land. He just worked it. Okay, and then the lord got everything. So on top you had a lord, and then you had on top of the lord, you often had a king. Okay, the king in the ancient world was a god or a demigod. All kings were deified, virtue without exception. All the Caesars of Rome who worshipped as gods, they were completely above the law. And you had maybe a warrior class and a priestly class, but you had a huge number of have-nots and a tiny, teeny elite of haves. What gave the nobility the right to rule, like they were democratically elected by the masses of the people to represent them in a parliamentary government?
Sword.
Sorry? Sword. The sword. I would say more basic than that, the golden rule. What's the golden rule? He who has the gold makes the rules. Birth, how much money you have, who you killed off. Had nothing to do with your qualifications to lead or whether the people wanted you to lead. If you didn't like it, tough. Lord would kill you. Between the masses of the lower class, serfs, peasants, whatever, and the upper class, was there equality before the law? Like the serf, the noble's riding through his field one day and he steps on the serf's foot with his horse and the serf says, you know, that's it, you broke my toe, I'm taking 3 months vacation, I'm not paying my taxes, I'm calling my lawyer. No, it's complete inequality. You know, in medieval feudal society, you actually had, if you saw the movie Braveheart, you actually had a thing which was called droit de seigneur, prima noce. The lord would say, now this wasn't, to be fair, it wasn't practiced that often, but the lord had the right to say, you peasant are my property, your bride is my property also, therefore on your wedding night I get to rape her before you get to have her as a wife. No idea of equality or justice. That's the history of humanity. The vast majority of people have nots. Now to be fair, who invented the word democracy or the concept? What language is it from? Do you know? Interesting. The Greeks. Demo is people, crassy government. And the Greeks had the most perfect democracy in human history. Citizens vote directly. Today we have like parliamentary government or Congress. You vote for someone who hopefully shows up in the parliament or Congress and votes the way you elect them to vote. Okay, so democracy is not perfect. You know, Winston Churchill said it beautifully. It's been said that democracy is the worst form of government except for every other system that's been tried from time to time throughout history. But we appreciate. Today we have a fundamental idea, right? Democracy, great thing. The Greeks invented it. Ah, the Greeks voted directly. Every citizen voted directly on issues. No representational democracy. But who were citizens in Greece who could vote? Adult men with land. Only men, free males of aristocratic background, were allowed to vote. Athens had estimated, let's say, 500,000 people 2,500 years ago, of whom more than half were slaves. Women were also cut out. Freedmen, artists, aliens, everyone cut out. A few thousand men could run the country. They were allowed to vote. Now, certainly, that's better than one megalomaniac dictator, but it's not really a democracy. Like we imagine a democracy today, one person, one vote. It's called an oligarchy. But certainly, an idea of one person, one vote is unheard of, even amongst the Greeks, who, by the way, viewed the idea of lower class people voting together with aristocracy as not only illogical, but immoral. If you look at quote number 5, this is Henry Phelps Brown of Oxford University. What does he say? He said, "The Greeks distinguished strongly between different types of persons and thought it only proper to treat them differently. This inequality of treatment they endorsed in the name of justice, an endorsement that with Aristotle included the justification for slavery. Only those men were citizens who had certain qualifications. Beyond them, it was taken for granted were all women, but also farmers, laborers, mechanics, freedmen, slaves, and aliens." So an idea of justice and equality in the ancient world, which doesn't mean you didn't have law and order, separate thing. Equal treatment before the law is virtually unknown in the ancient world. Another great value of our utopian world falls by the wayside. Okay, let's go down to number four, education and literacy. Now today, again, if you come from a Western liberal democratic country, you appreciate that one of the most basic responsibilities the government has is to provide a minimum level of education to the citizens. You should be functionally literate, reading, writing, arithmetic, as they say. But not only that, it's an obvious point that you would think that all leaders of countries would want to do that. What do you think is one of the major distinguishing factors that separates the first from the third world today? Literacy. There's no such thing as a first world country with a large rate of illiteracy or a third world country with a high rate of literacy. They go hand in hand because the economic, scientific, cultural development of a country depends on having literate people. So you'd imagine that every world leader throughout history would be spending huge amounts of their government funds to educate the masses. What's the reality, however? What do you think historians estimate is the number of people? Go back to Joe Average. What do you think, of all the people who've lived in the last 6,000 years since the dawn of civilization, what do you think historians say is the number of people who could read and write? Basic functional literacy. What percentage of humanity? Take a guess. Half of what? Half of humanity, 50%? Less than 1%. 99.999% of all the people who've ever lived could not read. By the way, what's the rate of literacy in the world today? 30%. Okay, there are huge countries like India that has 900 and something million people, of which at least half of them are functionally illiterate. Okay, now 30% is a huge jump over less than 1%. The question is, why? Why haven't more people been literate? Why do you think? Why have more people been literate in history?
It's trouble.
It's trouble, meaning?
Well, they got to the top, the people down
there. Right. Educated people are dangerous, they're harder to control. That's the second answer. It's very true. It's very true. There's a more basic answer. Right, education's a luxury. What's the goal of Joe Average Peasant, even in the world today, and certainly in the ancient world, what's Joe Average Peasant's goal on a daily basis?
Survive,
right? I gotta eat, got a meager I gotta eat. You know, we don't appreciate, even if you're from a lower middle class family in America, you don't appreciate how good you have it. The ancient world, and again, it's not just the ancient world, it's much of the third world today. People, you know, they have to worry about wars and famine and disease and their kids dying. And, you know, 40,000 children a day die of diarrhea in the world. Isn't that amazing? 40,000 children a day. Disease and women dying in childbirth. And no, there was no medical care in most places in the ancient world, medical care. People at the age of 20 looked like they were 40. And at the age of 40, they had no teeth and they were dead. What do you mean send my kid to school? The few that live to maturity, what do they have to do? You have to eke out a meager living on a little teeny plot of land so we don't starve to death. And it's in the world today. I've seen five-year-old kids. I've been to Egypt. Five-year-old kids working on construction sites. It's a luxury. Who could afford the luxury of educating their children? The teeny tiny elite upper class, by the way, many of them didn't bother either. So number one, it's a luxury. Most people couldn't afford it. Number two, as you said correctly, educated people are dangerous. Who starts all the problems in America in like the 1960s and in Europe? Late 60s, early 70s. College students, right? Those people who, they're all idealistic. They think they're going to live forever. They're going to change the world. They're not old and cynical yet. George Bernard Shaw said it beautifully. Anyone who's not liberal at age 20 has no heart, and who isn't conservative by age 40 has no brain. It's a great quote. But you think about it, educated people are dangerous. Now, we today, you know, because we live in democracies where we have to get reelected, the government leaders are concerned about the welfare of their country and getting reelected. In the ancient world, and by the way, not just the ancient world, most of the third world is still the same thing. In non-democratic countries, the goal of most all world leaders in history was to stay in power. They could care less how developed their country was. You know, forget it. I don't care. I'd rather have all my population ignorant than run a third world country and I could run around in a limo and have an army and my bodyguards and everyone else could be starving to death as long as I'm in power. That's the reality of human history. People just don't want to educate people. Now, Greece and Rome, to be fair, especially Rome, which had to officiate over a huge empire, needed a mass of literate people as bureaucrats. So they did have a school system, but it was not free public education. But they needed to have, by the way, the literacy rate in Greece and Rome was between 10 and 15%, which is like, wow, compared to less than 1%. But you think about it, 90% of the people in Rome were illiterate, one of the greatest civilizations in history, intentionally so. And if you look, it's interesting. Look at quote number 7. This is William V. Harris of Harvard University. excellent book on the history of literacy. What does he say? The written culture of antiquity was in the main restricted to a privileged minority. It should be obvious that in Greece, and to an even greater extent in the Roman Empire, the illiteracy of the masses contributed to the stability of political order. The disturbances caused by the spread of literacy, on the other hand, have been numerous and varied. The Greeks and Romans would have become very different people if, per impossibile, they had achieved mass literacy. They deliberately kept people in the dark. Keep them stupid, keep them disenfranchised, you can control them. So another great value falls by the wayside, education and literacy. Okay, family and family values. Again, today we appreciate that stable family is the building block of stable society and the chief means whereby we are able to socialize children. Everyone has family. It's not a new invention of any one culture. There's different variations on the theme. So I want to look at a subcategory of family, which is something that not only affected the stability of family, but had a huge impact on countries and whole empires, which is something I know you never learned about. Of all the things I know we're going to look at today, this is the one you never heard because they can't teach it to you. But it's the impact of the concept of the physical modesty and sexuality throughout human history and its effect on stability and family and morality. It's a tremendously powerful topic, which there happen to be a huge number of books written about, but you just can't talk about it in public school because it's too racy. But if you look at the topic, it's fascinating. You know, today, we in the West, I don't mean, again, anyone personally here, but we in the West view ourselves as being very liberated. Freedom of speech is such a basic right of the Constitution in America. We do have, like, you know, this is rated R, but pretty much anything goes. And we also appreciate that with the general lax attitude towards modesty and sexuality in the world, you know, sex has come to the forefront. If you look in advertising, when I was a little kid, I remember Barbara Eden, I Dream of Jeannie, they couldn't show her belly button on the show because it was too racy. Now, all they do is show as much body as possible. The product is almost irrelevant when advertising. It's show beautiful young people who all look fantastic. No one in reality actually looks like that. And if I buy that product because I want to look like that. There was a commercial show on Israeli television which just came from Europe. It won all these awards. It was close-up of pieces of a woman's body with New Age music playing. They don't show you anything too racy, but it's obviously very suggestive. And running down the body is a bead of water with this cool music going. And then it comes to rest in what must be her navel. And as it stops moving, all it says is BMW. There's nothing about a car in that commercial. So we today think, you know, sexuality, it's everywhere, it permeates society. The ancient world, believe it or not, we are like Puritans compared to the ancient world. The most racy society of the West is nothing compared to the ancient world. The whole concept of physical, sexual, morality, modesty, completely different. A couple of examples, you know, the Olympic Games, which are these these sporting events we have every 4 years. Where did they begin? Right, Greece and Rome, primarily in Greece. So the Olympic tournaments carried throughout the world, but they begin in Greece. Olympus was the mountain where the gods lived. They were these pseudo-military sporting events where young boys ran, wrestled, threw spears. It was all done in the nude. Okay? Which is a good thing they didn't have advertising back then because they had no place to put the Nike signs. If the Greeks and Romans had advertising, I postulate their empire would have collapsed in about 6 months. But how you looked was extremely important because every bit of you was there to be seen. And if you look at Greek and Roman art, there's a tremendous emphasis on perfection of the physical form. You never see a paunchy Greek or Roman statue. Granted, all the women are a little heavier because throughout history, being a little heavy was a sign you were eating and you were not starving to death. Only in the modern world do we actually think it is chic to look anorexic and like you're dying of hunger. But it's perfection of the physical form. And the whole concept of modesty was completely different. Public toilets in places like Greece and Rome were not a little booth you went in. You sat on a bench. People walked by. Hi. You know, you talked to them. There's no concept of nudity. Who cares? Nudity, everything, you know, everything goes. And if you go into the area of sexuality, the contrast is even more extreme. Now, again, today in the West, people say what consenting adults want to do behind closed doors, no problem. We're liberated. We can do whatever we like. In the ancient world, there was no closed doors to be behind. There was no closet to come out of. It's interesting. Homosexuality is a ubiquitous thing. To be either bisexual or homosexual is universal and incredibly common practice throughout human history. This is the only period of time in relatively modern time in history where people actually looking down at something abnormal. Ancient world, it was totally normal. There was no idea of coming out of a closet. Sexuality completely permeated the ancient world. You know, today, what's the institution we look at as being like the most anti-sexual in the world? Catholic Church, you know, the nuns, and, you know, in the ancient world, every single religion was steeped in sexuality. All the creation myths are stories of the gods creating the world through sexual activity, gods and people having, they had, and you had temple prostitutes, and you had temple orgies, and you had huge phallic symbols outside your houses, and little kids wore them around their necks, and fertility rites, and it was all natural and 100% fine, and a complete attitude of openness that makes even the most liberal-minded person in Amsterdam today cringe with, you know, with shock. Now, specifically, I want to focus on one little example, which is the most fascinating of all. Now, even in a world that, say, has no problem with homosexuality, adult men do whatever they like behind closed doors, even the most liberated society will say, little boys, adult men, you stay away from 11-year-old boys. That's pederasties, that's an offense, don't touch them. The Greeks, for instance, who totally glorified in general homosexuality, viewed pederasties, a relationship between an adult man and a little boy, prepubescent, as not only the highest form of love, but a vital part of a child's education. Meaning, if you, as middle-aged Greek parents, you had an 11-year-old son, if your neighbor did not take your, obviously another upper-middle-class Greek, did not take your son in for a sexual, but not just sexual, it had to be emotional and intellectual, it had to be a meaningful relationship, did not take your 11-year-old son into such a relationship, it would be the equivalent today of like a Jewish parent's kids not getting into college. No one wants Demetrius? You know, can you imagine, God forbid today, someone does that to your kid? You drive your like Range Rover through his living room and blow him away with a shotgun. Highest form of love. And again, this is something the philosophers all talked about. If you look at Plato's Symposium in quote number 8, what does Plato say? He's talking about men and boys. He says, I, for my part, am at a loss to say what a greater blessing a man can have in earliest youth than an honorable lover. If we could somehow contrive to have a city or an army composed of lovers and their favorites, they could not be better citizens of their country. No man is such a craven that love's own influence cannot inspire him with valor that makes him equal to the bravest born. It's macho. I found this to be fascinating. We have an image of the effeminate homosexual male. You know, let's get him, you know, that kind of guy. Not at all. The Greeks viewed this as the most macho thing. Japanese samurai culture also. Real men chase boys. The Greeks viewed men who chased women excessively as effeminate. Fascinating. Totally different idea. By the way, the Spartans, remember Athens and Sparta, the city-states that fought with each other? Sparta, the most militaristic state in human history, they followed Plato very seriously. They had whole bands of soldiers, whole military units, called the Theban Brotherhood, the Theban Bands, of older men who fought together in battle with their boyfriends. And this wasn't a bunch of guys in pumps and tutus charging over hills with feather dusters yelling, let's get them, boys, you know? This was the most macho units of the Greek army because no one wanted to die ingloriously in front of their lover. Totally different attitude. Now, I know it's fascinating, you never heard it, but the question is, what are the implications? What do you think it did towards women? What do you think the view in Greek society, such a sophisticated society, what do you think they thought of women? One of the most misogynist cultures in human history was Greece, precisely because they were so sexually out of control, the men. You want to see what they felt? Look at quote number 9. Greek poet Palladius, 2,500 years ago. Marriage brings a man only two happy days, the day he takes his bride to bed and the day he lays her in her grave. And by the way, on a wedding night, a Greek man would dress his bride in men's clothes. And look at the next quote from a contemporary of Palladius, Propertius. May all my enemies fall in love with women and may all my friends with boys. Obviously, you know, I hate to be a woman in that society. You ever heard the expression barefoot pregnant in the kitchen? That was a Greek woman. On one hand, sophisticated society, but misogynist to the extreme. Now, Rome, to be fair, and by the way, you find variations all over the world. Rome, to be fair, treated women considerably better, but they had their own form of licentiousness, which had tremendous impact on society. Now, Romans, by the way, did not believe that a Roman male should be a passive partner with another male, because a Roman man was meant to dominate everything. And to be passive in a sexual relationship with a male would make him meek. Now, for a Roman man to dominate his male slaves in a sexual relationship, no problem. But then again, even Julius Caesar, you know, who was openly, he's such a macho guy, but openly homosexual. Suetonius, the Roman historian, said about him, he was every man's woman and every woman's man. So he, because he was so macho, so he could be passive. But they had tremendous licentiousness and prostitution and you name it. And the implications were tremendous. What do you think it did for stable families, especially in the upper class, which was most prevalent? The leadership of the country. Ugh, terrible. Read the lives of the 12 Caesars. Look at what's going on in the society, rotten from the top down. But on a more practical level, what do you think it did to the birth rate? Greece, probably Rome, definitely had to pass laws requiring men to marry and have children if they wanted to pass their property on. Why? because people were too busy chasing boys and prostitutes and everyone else's wives and you name it to bother to have their own children. You had to have legitimate children through marriage. And by the way, it had huge impact. The Roman Empire, Rome built one of the greatest empires in human history because peasant Roman soldiers fought and died for their country. 500 years it stood. When it collapsed, it was rotten inside. When the barbarians overran it in 476 of the Common Era, there was nothing left. By the way, they couldn't even support an army. Their birth rate was so low, they had to pay mercenaries to defend their country. So the whole idea of physicality, sexuality, the tremendous damage to the stability of family. Whole empires, not forget, just family falling apart. Whole empires collapsed because of lack of values and sexual control in society. Last but not least, social responsibility, which today is such a big thing. You know, we have that song, "We Are the World, Take Responsibility for Everything." This is a point I could spend 2 seconds on because it's obvious. In a world where you have human sacrifice and warfare and infanticide and inequality and illiteracy and you name it, is not going to be a world where people care. And that's a reality. Today in the West, every liberal democracy has social welfare programs. If you're homeless or if you need Medicaid or whatever, they don't always work great, but it's a basic responsibility all citizens are entitled to. Every one of those programs, almost without exception, has come into existence in the last 100, 150 years. Before that time, you had nothing. In Rome 2,000 years ago, remarkably advanced civilization, if you were poor, hungry, sick, homeless, diseased, and you didn't have family to help you, tough. Die. No one cared. Rome had 1.5 million people living in it 2,000 years ago. There was no free public hospital or hospice or anything. Now that's rulers towards their own citizens. You can imagine how people reacted towards the rest of the world. Today we have, you know, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and UNICEF and the United Nations and Doctors Without Borders. We had an earthquake in Afghanistan 2 weeks ago. Everyone flies in food aid and rescue equipment and doctors come in. You think in the ancient world you had like the International Monetary Fund? Or even better yet, multinational peacekeeping force. Can you imagine asking Rome to send in a peacekeeping force? They would send 50,000 Roman legionaries to destroy your country. You had no concept of collective responsibility of humanity in the ancient world. Genghis Khan, who was like one of the greatest, we look down on him because he was from Asia, but he was one of the greatest world conquerors and diplomat and statesman in human history. He had the largest physical empire in the world until the British came along in the 19th century. His attitude of what's meaningful in the world is far more in keeping with how most government rulers looked at social responsibility than any modern concept of caring. If you look at quote number 10, what does Genghis Khan say? "The greatest happiness is to vanquish your enemies, to chase them before you, to rob them of their wealth and see those dear to them bathed in tears, to clasp to your bosom their wives and daughters." Rape and pillage is where it's at. That's meaningful. That's pleasure. One of the great humanitarian thinkers. Now, what's the point? And the point is not that everyone in the ancient world were these horrible, evil people. No, the average person is just trying to survive. And there was law and there was culture and many civilizations contributed fantastically positive things, that for sure. What we don't see, however, is even the most sophisticated civilizations that make up so much of what the West is today, and all of human culture for that matter, even in those civilizations, these are not the values. We don't get those values from any of those cultures, and if we don't get it from them, the question is, where do we get it from? There's a historian whose name is Paul Johnson. He's a world-class, very well-known historian. He's English, he's Christian. His expertise is Christian history. He also wrote a book called The History of the Jews, which in my mind is proof of the supernatural because it was on the New York Times bestseller list for 3 months. How a Jewish history book is a bestseller is beyond me. But in the epilogue of this very interesting book on Jewish history, he writes, if you look at quote number 11, it's a fascinating quote. When you read the quote, keep in mind the list on the board. He says, "One way of summing up 4,000 years of Jewish history is to ask ourselves, what would have happened to the human race if Abraham had not been a man of great sagacity, or if he had stayed in Ur and kept his higher notions to himself and no specific Jewish people had come into being? Certainly the world without the Jews would have been a radically different place. Humanity might eventually have stumbled upon all the Jewish insights, but we cannot be sure. All the great conceptual discoveries of the human intellect seem obvious and inescapable once they have been revealed, but it requires a special genius to formulate them for the first time. The Jews had this gift. To them we owe the idea of equality before the law, both divine and human, of the sanctity of life and the dignity of human person, of individual conscience and so of personal redemption, of collective conscience and so of social responsibility, of peace as an abstract ideal and love as the foundation of justice, and many other items which constitute the basic moral furniture of the human mind. Without the Jews, it might have been a much emptier place. Above all, the Jews taught us how to rationalize the unknown. The result was monotheism and the three great religions which profess it. It is almost beyond our capacity to imagine how the world would have fared if they had never emerged. And it's a good thing that a non-Jew said that, because if a Jew said it, we'd never believe it. But it's an incredible quote. It's almost exactly the same list that we came up with. And he's saying the basic moral furniture of the human mind is a product of the Jews, which does not, he's not saying, and I'm not saying, we're great, we're perfect, everyone else is evil. No. We have, there's been, unfortunately, lots of bad Jews in the world. We've made our share of mistakes. There have been plenty of righteous non-Jews, who, and there have been plenty of people and civilizations that have contributed lots of wonderful things to the world. That's not the issue. In the realm of giving humanity its conscience, creating a moral vision that the whole world is today bought into, we're the giants. Which is kind of funny, because we're such a little insignificant people. Yet in the realm of ideas, not in human power or physical empire building, but in the area of human power, we have really the greatest empire in human history. Which is tremendous. Now, what I'd like to do now is actually go, just as we went through this list and looked at how different was the rest of the world's attitude towards these values, I now want to go through it from the Jewish perspective to show you where these ideas come from within Judaism. Which doesn't, by the way, mean that we invented the concept of peace, per se. Other people will find talking about it. But it's because of our unique relationship to ideas and connecting them to another more powerful idea, which we'll see in a few minutes, that those ideas took on tremendous power and influence in the world. So what we're going to do is go through the list now, and what I want to we're going to see in each one of these areas that Judaism is going to introduce a concept or an idea which is going to be revolutionary and have a huge impact. And it's going to ultimately be responsible for changing the way all of humanity today looks at these values. So to begin with, value of life. The best example of the radically different idea that Judaism had towards the value of life is the sixth of the Ten Commandments. Anyone know what the sixth of the Ten Commandments is? Thou shalt not murder, correct. Most people say kill, which is incorrect. Lo tirtzach is murder. There's a difference. Judaism, we taught the world the value of life, the sanctity of life. But Judaism also, we're not pacifists. In Jewish law, there is a death penalty. But because we believe life is so valuable, it is very difficult to sentence someone to death in a Jewish court. We taught the world, as we'll see in a minute, the idea of peace. But Judaism says, look, if it's good or evil, you don't like turn the other cheek. You have to fight evil. There's times you have to go to war, but peace is the ideal. So it's thou shalt not murder. We taught the world you don't have human sacrifice. You don't kill babies. You don't kill for sport. It's very interesting. If you look in the Talmud, you've all seen Schindler's List, the movie, right? Everyone's seen Schindler's List. There's a very powerful scene at the end of the movie where when the camp has been liberated and they're about to send Oskar Schindler off, and the inmates whose lives he saved make him a ring. And they engrave on the inside of this gold ring a quote from the Talmud, which is quote 15. It's from the Talmud in Sanhedrin. He who saves one life, it's as if he saves an entire universe. He who destroys a life, it's as if he destroys an entire universe. This is being said at the same time by the rabbis of the Talmud as the Romans are killing thousands of people for sport. Radically different idea. The idea that life has intrinsic value, it is sacred, Jewish contribution to the consciousness of humanity. Number two, peace and harmony. If you study the history of the idea of peace, it's very clear that the first people to come up with the idea that peace is the permanent state to which all humanity is supposed to evolve, the ideal state, the messianic state, that's the Jewish people. The prophets talk about it everywhere. And if you look at Maimonides, who was one of the great rabbis in medieval Spain, Egypt, he codified all of his Jewish philosophy in his monumental work, the Mishneh Torah. Not his own ideas. He's basically just giving in a very organized form, basic Jewish philosophy. And in it he says, this is 850 years ago, if you look at quote 16, look at how different was the Jewish idea of what the world should be like. The sages and prophets did not long for the messianic era in order to rule the world nor to subdue the nations, but to be free to pursue Torah and its wisdom. At that time there will be no hunger and no war, no jealousy and no strife. The entire world will be entirely occupied to inquire the knowledge of God. As it says, the world will be full of the knowledge of God as the waters cover the sea. So we see this idea of peace, that the Jewish worldview, not to conquer the world. By the way, the best proof of the unique Jewish contribution to the concept of peace is today to look at the organization that is in theory dedicated to world peace. What's that organization? The United Nations, which also seems to be dedicated to condemning Israel all the time. The UN has passed or tried to pass more resolutions condemning Israel than any country in its history. Don't you know this is the most evil spot on earth? You know, but the point is not to rag on the UN, but to show it's not a pro-Jewish lobby, that's for sure. But if you look outside General Assembly headquarters of the United Nations, the organization dedicated to world peace and brotherhood, there is a wall. That wall is named the Isaiah Wall. And on the Isaiah wall, who's Isaiah? He's a Jewish prophet. And on the wall named after him is one of the most famous quotes that he said, which is in the Bible, which is quote 18. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. Because the people who set up the UN know that the people who invented the idea of peace as the ultimate state for all of humanity to be in are the Jews. Radical idea. Number three, justice and equality. The word justice, anyone in Hebrew, anyone know what the word is? Tzedek, right. The word appears over and over. There's an obsession with this idea of tzedek, justice. It's interesting, by the way, tzedakah, which we always translate as charity, actually means justice, which has a very powerful lesson in that concept. But we all know the very famous saying, tzedek, tzedek, tirdof, justice, justice, you shall pursue, the saying from the Bible. Double emphasis. If you look in, you have one homework assignment. Everyone has to look in Leviticus chapter 19, because if you want to see all of the principles that basically govern how Jews are supposed to treat each other, it's in Leviticus 19. And if you want to see, by the way, where all the inspiration came from that fueled all of the great political thinkers of the last 200 years, look in Leviticus 19. They all pulled it right out of the Bible. And if you look in Leviticus 19:15, tremendous statement. You shall do no unrighteousness in judgment. You shall not respect the person of the poor, nor honor the person of the mighty, but in righteousness you shall judge your neighbor. Justice must be meted out fairly, regardless of how much money or power a person has. And by the way, we see this not just in theory, in practice. There's a couple of examples which illustrate what a radically different concept the Jews had of power than anyone else. First of all, king. Now, in the ancient world, by the way, most people misunderstand the Jewish form of government. It's not a theocracy like the left in Israel talks about. The mullahs, the rabbis, the mullahs, they're going to take over, you know. It's not a theocracy. Judaism had a system of government, which, by the way, is the basis for the modern American system of government, which is specific people with specific powers separated by different responsibilities, like Congress and the president. In the ancient biblical state of Israel, you had a king. Okay, and he had certain rights, privileges, and responsibilities. You had a chief religious figure who was the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. And then you had a court system, very sophisticated court system. At the top was the Supreme Court of the Jewish people, right, the Sanhedrin. And if you look, there's just two examples. Look at the king. You know, in the ancient world, kings were, we don't appreciate monarchy today because monarchs don't have power. Like, what monarchy do we know of? The Queen of England. The poor woman, she has to pay taxes, she has no political power, and she gets no nachas from her kids. But in the ancient world, kings and queens were gods or demigods. They were completely above the law. Okay, by Renaissance, you know, Middle Ages, Enlightenment, kings like Louis XIV said in the 16th century, you know, excuse me, 17th century, he said, L'état c'est moi, I am the state. You know, okay, so he already was on a level where he only was the state. He wasn't a god anymore, but he ruled by divine right. It's interesting, Jewish law had a radically different concept of king. You know, every Jew is supposed to write a Torah scroll. We'll see why in a second. A king has to write a Torah scroll like every other citizen of the country of Israel, but he also has to write a second one as king, a little mini one, and wear it on his arm. Wherever he went, the king had to wear a Sefer Torah attached to his arm. Why? If you look at quote 21 from the book of Deuteronomy, and when the king sits on the throne of his kingdom, he will write a copy of the Torah, and it will be with him, and he will read from it all the days of his life, so that he will learn to fear the Lord his God, to keep all the words of Torah and do its statutes. The king has to know there's a King of Kings, God. No one is above the law. Rather, he is supposed to exemplify the law, the ideal citizen, God-fearer. And even more powerful, by the way, the chief legal authority in Israel was not the king, it was the Sanhedrin. 70 judges. To sit on the Sanhedrin, by the way, is fascinating. To be the most powerful people in Israel, what was the qualifications? Remember, anywhere else it was how much money you had, who you killed off, birth. To sit on the Sanhedrin, it's fascinating. You know what the qualifications were? You had to be married with children. A. Why? Because the Sanhedrin could pass the death sentence, and every person is someone's child, and being a parent teaches you sensitivity to life. As a parent myself, I know the fact that I haven't killed any of my kids yet has certainly taught me that. No, but seriously, you get a tremendous sensitivity to life as a parent. But number two, you had to have unquestioning integrity and encyclopedic knowledge of everything, especially Torah. And you see examples of this. Like a great example is Shammai and Hillel. Two of the greatest rabbis who lived, we're talking about, you know, over 2,000 years ago, who ran the Sanhedrin. Shammai was one of the richest people in the world. We know why he was up there, right? He had money and power. Not at all. He happened to have money, but he was the best guy for the job. Hillel had nothing. He was incredibly poor. You never see in the Talmud, when they're always debating points of law, Hillel, Shammai never says to Hillel, "Hillel, how much money do you have? Shut up, I'll have you killed." When they debate a point of law, it's based solely on the strength of their argument. Can you imagine what all of human history would be like if the ability to rule were based on knowledge and integrity as opposed to money and power? I mean, all of human history would be different. Completely different idea of responsibility in the world. So there you see a practical thing, equality before the law. Okay, opportunity goes according to your abilities, not according to just your money and your power. Now down to number four, education and literacy. This is a point you never have to convince a Jewish audience of. Most Jews think, you know, the big Ten Commandments, most Jews think they're actually 13. I'll do two of those three now. The 11th commandment most Jews believe is thou shalt go to college. The American addendum to that is preferably Ivy League. It's an obsession in the Jewish world. It's very interesting. Jews are always obsessed with knowledge. Now, we, by the way, have a unique position in human history. Unlike the rest of the world, which had 99% illiteracy, we are the only people in human history to have virtual 100% literacy, which doesn't mean at all periods of time everywhere Jews could read. There were low levels of Jewish illiteracy. But compared to anyone else, we were literally, even till today, far ahead of anyone else. And you see, it's just in Jews and education in America. You know, Jews who are 2.5% of the population of America make up about 10% of the student body of every major university in America, and 25% of the student body and faculty of all of the top schools in the United States. And, you know, you see it reflects in Jewish accomplishment. It's a nice point of Jewish pride. But it seems that the focus on literacy is such a fundamental thing throughout Jewish history. It is not a new thing, wherever we look at all periods of time. The question is why? Why are Jews so obsessed with literacy? And it's, again, a radical idea. The rest of the world, remember we said, you pointed out, the rest of the world kept people stupid to control them. It's completely antithetical to the Jewish worldview. Completely antithetical. Judaism teaches fundamental point, every human being has free will. We're supposed to exercise our free will in a meaningful way to bring about positive change in the world. If you are ignorant, there's a limit to how you can exercise that will. Ignorant people are limited in their abilities. You have to be educated. It's a fundamental responsibility. And you want to see how strongly that is stated. Look at Maimonides again, quote 22. Look at the language, the strength of the language he uses here. Appoint teachers for the children in every country, province, and city. In any city that does not have a school, excommunicate the people of the city until they get teachers for the children. If they don't, destroy the city, because the world exists only because of the breath of children studying. I mean, look at that. They said, people are going to be ignorant. The whole purpose of creation is forget it. Can you imagine if they followed this rule in Europe? You know, there'd be no Gentiles left in the world. They'd all be killed in the Middle Ages. No one could read. Lest you think, by the way, this is purely, you know, Maimonides propagandizing because he's a Jew. And, you know, look at quote 23. This is a contemporary of Maimonides. I'm sure they never met. But he's a very famous medieval French Catholic monk, theologian, Peter Abelard. What does he say? A Jew, however poor, if he had 10 sons, would put them all to letters. Not for gain as the Christians do, but for the understanding of God's law, and not only his sons, but his daughters. Jews value educating their children because they want them to take responsibility for the world. It's a reality. You can prove it, no problem. Every Jew knows it's true. You know, that's it. Obsessive focus on this idea of being educated. Okay, if you go to family and family values... Again, another point you don't have to convince Jews of, family is very important to us. If for no other reason, it's an excuse to get together and eat, which is the major cultural pastime of the Jewish people. By the way, I saw a great summary of all Jewish holidays. This is a great one. They tried to kill us. We won. Let's eat. Works almost all the time. It's amazing. But going back to the idea of family... We who lived, you look at other ethnic or religious groups who've gone through very difficult situations. Many of these groups, and I don't want to name names, but their family structure has fallen apart completely. One of the great miracles of Jewish history is the fact that regardless of our socioeconomic status, and specifically, actually, Jewish families do better when they're poor and oppressed, you know, divorce-wise and otherwise, even in the worst situation, the Jewish family has been an incredible island of stability in a very chaotic world, even at the worst periods of time. And it comes from, again, a very basic and very profound concept we introduced to the world, which if you look at quote number 24, this is Genesis 2:24. When God creates the first human beings, he says, a man shall leave his mother and father and cleave to his wife, and they will become one flesh. This is not talking about sex. Judaism saying it's not like a team. Judaism says a man and a woman are two halves of a whole. Kabbalistically, metaphysically, we say it's called zivug. And that a man is supposed to direct his emotional and especially his physical sexual energy into a woman, which is a relationship that is based on not just a legally binding relationship, but a relationship based on love and respect. Tremendously powerful idea. We invented the idea of homosexuality. Fascinating. Until the Jews came along and said, sorry guys, you can't have sex with other men or boys or other people's wives or prostitutes or animals. By the way, bestiality is a very common practice. Almost all medical historians agree that all sexually transmitted diseases came from animals. Okay, they jumped over through sexual relations between men and animals. Inanimate objects, you name it. Judaism says no. Sexuality is controlled in a relationship called marriage with a wife. And by the way, in Jewish law, people always say, you know, Jews only do it to have kids. It's not true. Interesting point of Jewish law is that a man has a legal obligation to sexually satisfy his wife. Not doing so in Jewish law is grounds for divorce. I always tell the guys, sorry, it doesn't go the other way. But they have a tremendously profound, different concept of how a man should treat a wife. And the best expressed, by the way, Maimonides in quote 25. I always tell all the guys when I teach these groups of single guys, Maimonides gives you in one sentence the secret to how to remain happily married for 50 years. It says, and so our rabbis decreed that a man should honor his wife more than himself and love her as much as he loves himself. That's it. You have to control yourself, guys. You know, that's it. That's the reality. And if you look at Dennis Prager in quote 26, this is an excellent article on Judaism and homosexuality. He says, man's nature, undisciplined by values, will allow sex to dominate his life and the life of society. When Judaism demanded that all sexual activity be channeled into marriage, it changed the world. It is not overstated to say that the Torah's prohibition of non-marital sex made the creation of Western civilization possible. Societies that did not place boundaries around sexuality were stymied in their development. The subsequent dominance of the Western world can, to a significant extent, be attributed to the sexual revolution initiated by Judaism and later carried forward by Christianity. That's the last time you're ever going to hear monogamy called the sexual revolution, but suffice it to say, in history, it is a very profound idea with huge implications for the development of civilization. Last, and certainly not least, is the concept of social responsibility, which, again, you never have to convince a Jewish audience of. If Jews think the 11th commandment is thou shalt go to college, they think the 12th is thou shalt surely give to the UJA. And by the way, it's interesting, for many Jews who are completely unaffiliated, donating to the UJA is their last point of contact with the Jewish community in the Jewish world. Interesting statistic I got from the UJA. The UJA, by the way, raises Jews being about 2.5% of the population of America. The UJA raises from 12% of that 2.5% every year they raise money, which means 800,000 people a year give money to the UJA. As such, it raises $750 million a year, making it the third largest charity in the United States after the Red Cross and the United Way, and therefore the third largest charity in the world, which is amazing. That's from raising from 12% of the American population, that's, you know, 12% of the 2.5% of the American population that's Jewish, which is a tremendous testament to Jewish generosity. And by the way, Jews get to a lot of causes that aren't Jewish. And this is not a new phenomenon that comes out of Jews having a lot of money in America in the late 20th century. Anywhere you look, and we have clear historical proof for this throughout Jewish history, there is no little shtetl anywhere in Eastern Europe or any ghetto in Europe 500 years ago that did not have a vast array of social welfare programs. 5,000 Jews living in Venice 500 years ago had 35 charitable institutions. Of the 5 million Jews living in the Pale of Jewish Settlement, 386,000 square miles of poverty, where 5 million Jews lived 100 years ago under Tsarist oppression. That Jewish population, all of whom without exception were poor, supported between 15 and 25% of the rest of the population on private donations. It's incredible. That's the equivalent in America of like 47 million Americans being supported by the private donations of their fellow American citizens. It's unprecedented in history. This is a fundamental, this idea of giving, taking responsibility for the world. And it comes out of what is certainly one of the most radically innovative ideas in law that was ever introduced into the world, which you see again in the Bible. If you go back to quote 27 and quote 28, both Leviticus 19 again, our favorite chapter, you see two very profound statements. Number one is Lo Talmud al Dam Re'echa, don't stand on your neighbor's blood, which doesn't mean if you see someone bleeding, don't stand in it because it'll ruin your shoes. It means if you see your fellow human being in distress, economic, physical, emotional, you have a legal obligation to help. And more beautifully than that is one of the most famous quotes in the Bible, which the Christians love to use, but which is, of course, from Leviticus again. Quote 28, Ve'ahavta le'orecha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself. What does it mean? Like I stand on a corner with a smiley button on, I shake people's hands and I give them flowers. Judaism says, this is a radical concept. Now, if any lawyers here, it's interesting. All civilizations have to develop law. Without law, society can't function. It's not a Jewish invention. But all legal systems throughout human history are, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, because if you do those things, like murder, steal, rape, and pillage, the society will fall apart. Therefore, ergo, if you do not rape, murder, steal, pillage, whatever, you're a good citizen. I obey the law. Judaism says, no. Jewish law, that could be summed up by a very famous quote from the rabbis, Sur Meira Ve'Aseh Tov. Yes, you must refrain from doing those things which damage society, but you have a legal obligation to do good. You can't just, not doing bad doesn't make you good. Judaism says you're part of the problem or you're part of the solution. You have a legal obligation to actively do good. Love your neighbor as yourself means take responsibility for the world. And it's not just left up to your imagination. In Jewish law, you have to give a percentage of your income to charity. You have to take care of the widow and the orphan and the poor and the oppressed. They're all your responsibility. And it's not just Jews, by the way, it's Gentiles. Although, of course, charity begins at home. You got to take care of your family first and the Jewish people first. But Jews are remarkably generous towards non-Jews in history, not just in modern times. It's not just people, it's also animals. The first animal rights legislation anywhere in the world appears in the Torah. You know, in Jewish law, you can't eat until you fed your animal. Also environmental law. You can't chop down a fruit tree, even in the time of war. It's a whole sweeping vision of taking responsibility for the world. Actively doing good. One of the most powerful concepts in history. If everyone in the world adapted that in their countries, you'd have a completely different world right there. This has always been in Jewish consciousness. And if you look at, by the way, the great legal political thinkers of the last 200 years in Europe and America, who were so much responsible for creating liberal democratic society, virtually all of them will quote the Bible as their source of inspiration for their ideas. Look at quote 29. This is Thomas Huxley, who's one of the great English thinkers, biologist, writer. What does he say? The Bible has been the Magna Carta of the poor and the oppressed. Down to modern times, no state has had a constitution in which the interests of the people are so largely taken into account, in which the duties so much more than the privileges of the rulers are insisted upon as that drawn up for Israel in Deuteronomy and Leviticus. Nowhere is the fundamental truth that the welfare of the state in the long run depends on the righteousness of the citizens so strongly laid down. And even more beautifully, look at quote 30. This is an American preacher and publicist. Kyman Abbott, writing 100 years ago, what does he say? It would be impossible to mention any other people of even a much later age whose law and constitution embodied an ideal so noble as that embodied in Hebrew civil laws, or any people whose history shows the existence of political institutions so essentially just, free, and humane. We Gentiles owe our life to Israel. It is Israel who, in bringing us the divine law, has laid the foundation of liberty. It is Israel who had the first free institutions the world ever saw. When sometimes our own unchristian prejudices flame out against the Jewish people, let us remember that all that we have and all that we are, we owe under God to what Judaism has given to us. And all I can say is, would that the Christian world always felt that about the Jewish people. And again, just to summarize, again, it's not the question of we're great, everyone else is terrible, we've already went through that. But overwhelmingly, these ideas are overwhelmingly the product of the Jewish people. That is the Jewish utopian vision that humanity has accepted. Now, this presentation would not be complete without focusing on the last, final, and certainly most significant idea we introduced into the world. And there's one idea that is far more important than these. It's the idea from which all of these ideas derive logically and philosophically. It's the idea without which we have none of this. So the question is, besides great obvious Jewish contributions to civilization, such as bagels, gilt, junk bonds, leverage buyouts, Einstein, Marx, Freud, 22% of all Nobel Prizes in science since 1900, you know, all that stuff, what is by far the single most important idea we introduced to the world? Monotheism. Ethical monotheism. The belief in one God as the source of all morality, an absolute standard, that is the single most significant idea we introduced to the world. And without question, in terms of civilizing humanity, of giving mankind a conscience, that is the most important idea in human history, period. Undisputed. Incredibly powerful idea. And if you just look at the idea for a second, you see the implications of it. In the very beginning of the Bible, when God creates human beings, it says human beings are created, Bitzelem Elohim. Man is created in the image of God. Man and woman, we're talking about. What is the godlike thing that human beings have? It's clearly not physical, because God is, you know, he has no parts, he's infinite. What do we have that makes us special? What's the godlike image that all human beings have? It's a soul, neshama. Every human being has a higher spiritual intellectual essence, which is what separates us from animals. It makes us different. It's a piece of the infinite, the divine spark. Take that idea and look at it for a second. Just go to the value of life. If every human being right, is made in the image of God, and every human being has a divine spark. What does that say about the value of life? We have a piece of the infinite. Human life is priceless. Incredible. You know, that's why they say saving a life is like saving a universe, because every human being is this unique, special, godlike creation made in the image of God. Look at this one. Justice and equality. If every human being is made in the image of God, we all have that divine spark. We all have a soul. I have, you have, Jew, Gentile, man, woman, black, white, yellow. There's a basic equality amongst all human beings. We're all made in the image of God. The prophet Amos says it. Has not one God made us all? Are we not all his children? Fundamental. It's the basis of the idea of equality before the law. It's the idea of being made in the image of God. And social responsibility, that's really powerful. If we're made in the image of God, we have an obligation to act like him. One of the 613 commandments is, V'halachta bidrachav, be like God. What does that mean? Like I hang out in a cloud, I throw lightning bolts at people, I boss them around like a big bass voice, you know? What does it mean to be made in the image of God and to act like God? The rabbis say, V'halachta bidrachav, go in God's ways. Just as he is kind and merciful, so too do you have an obligation to be kind and merciful. Take responsibility for the world. God did it, you do it. We don't appreciate the power of this idea, but I want to look at just one person who does. Look at quote 31. This is John Adams, second president of the United States. He says it beautifully. I will insist the Hebrews have done more to civilize men than any other nation. If I were an atheist and believed in blind eternal fate, I should still believe that fate had ordained the Jews to be the most essential instrument for civilizing the nations. If I were an atheist of another sect who believed or pretended to believe that all is ordered by chance, I should still believe that chance had ordered the Jews to preserve and propagate for all mankind the doctrine of a supreme, intelligent, wise, almighty sovereign of the universe, which I believe to be the great essential principle of all morality and consequently of all civilization. They are the most glorious nation that ever inhabited this earth. The Romans and their empire are but a bubble in comparison of the Jews. They have given religion to three quarters of the globe and have influenced the affairs of mankind more and more happily than any other nation, ancient or modern. And if he were running for president, I would vote for him. So we see, the idea of one God is the most powerful idea in history. The last little teeny piece of the puzzle, everyone, the last little piece of the puzzle is how? You know, we understand how the Greeks and the Romans changed the world. They had huge empires, they conquered people, they stuffed their ideology down their throats. But how did a little insignificant Jewish people, 0.025% of the population of the world today, who everyone seems to universally hate, how did we get the world to buy into our vision? So I have to go back in time, almost 4,000 years. And 4,000 years ago, we see that all of humanity was polytheistic. Right, belief in multiple gods. Everyone was religious, but all polytheistic. You had, remember Greek mythology? You had the god of the Zeus, the god of the heavens, Poseidon, god of the sea. You had a whole pantheon of gods, each with their own little realm. And besides living forever and having superhuman powers, they behaved just like people. They ate, they slept around. They were some of the most debauched characters in the history of ancient literature, the gods themselves. And they manipulated you, and you manipulated them, and you were trapped in the world with them. It was a very confusing world. It was like Dallas on a cosmic scale. Not primitive, by the way. Some of the most sophisticated belief systems in human history are and were polytheistic. But because there were so many different gods running around, and you perceive that they all wanted different things from you, there was no one standard of morality. The whole world was amoral. What's amoral? Right, without morality. Into that world, about 3,800 years ago, appears one man in Iraq, Abraham. Abraham was great for two reasons. A, he lived in a world that was entirely polytheistic, yet with his clarity of vision, saw that polytheism was an illusion. There's one God. There's one God, and not just one versus many. This one God was the only God. He was an all-powerful, all-knowing God. This one God created the world. He didn't go on vacation. He stuck around. He wanted a relationship with his creation. And this one God was the source of all morality. Tremendously powerful idea. You know, as Dostoevsky, the great Russian writer, says, where there is no God, everything is permissible. In the ancient world, millions of gods do whatever you like. And by the way, you look at the words, ethics and morals, which today we refer to as, this is unethical, this is immoral. Ethics comes from the Greek word ethos, which means custom. Morals comes from the Latin word mores, which means custom. There's no idea of absolute right or wrong. What I do is I do because it's accepted by society. Abraham came along and said, no, polytheism is an illusion, amorality is a lie, and it leads to immorality. There is one God and there is one standard of right and wrong. Okay, now the world today says, you know, that's an incredible idea. That is the most revolutionary idea in human history. But then they ask the question I asked before. How odd of God to choose the Jews? Like, if this idea is so powerful, give it to the Greeks, give it to the Romans, give it to CNN. Peter Arnett can announce it, 6 o'clock news, you know, like they say. It's not news until CNN announces it, right? Peter Arnett will announce it, the whole world will know, 15 minutes, wouldn't take 4,000 years. How odd of God to choose the Jews. So what do the Jews answer back? We say, it wasn't so odd, the Jews chose God. Meaning Abraham's not walking along the street and God's sitting in heaven, eeny, meeny, money. Abraham. Abraham did the work. He was an incredible idealist, incredible free-thinking, dedicated human being. Because he said, I choose to live and if necessary to die for the reality of God. Can you imagine being the only person in the world to know that something is correct and not care what anyone else thinks? And not only that, not to keep it to yourself. He's the crusader. He's going to change the whole world. There's a great line, by the way, 1984, one of the greatest lines in literature. You read the book where Winston Smith, who's the hero, is trying, they're trying to brainwash him? And he says to his torturer there, he says, there are truths and there are untruths, and just because you're in a minority of one doesn't make you wrong. Abraham could have easily said that line. I don't care if the whole world worships millions of Getchkala idols. It doesn't make a difference to me. There's one God, there's one absolute reality. And so we say, how odd of God to choose the Jews. Wasn't so odd the Jews chose God. Abraham says, I choose to live and if necessary to die for the reality of one God. And God says, therefore, Abraham, I choose you. Because you chose me, I choose you. This is chosen people. Most misunderstood concept in Judaism. What are we chosen for? It's not privilege. It's responsibility. What's the responsibility? It's the responsibility of being, not to convert the whole world to Judaism. It's not jihad. We are supposed to be a living example of a nation that lives with the reality of God, to create a just and moral society based on the ideas of ethical monotheism that the whole world is going to come and learn from. A light to nations, chosen for the responsibility of being the model to enable the rest of humanity to perfect itself. It's the ultimate cause, right? Beats the heck out of Save the Whales. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. That's the Jewish battle cry. God is it, not Coca-Cola. The reality that runs existence, that we burn with every Jew has in their soul, even if they're not aware of it, is that reality. That's the most profound idea. And for 2,000 years, it was everyone in the world versus the Jews. Jews, you're out of your mind. One invisible God, you've got to be crazy. One example, by the way, to illustrate. Look at quote number 14. This is Deo Cassius, Roman historian 2,000 years ago. What does Deo Cassius say? The Jews are distinguished from the rest of mankind in practically every detail of life, and in particular by the fact that they do not honor any of the usual gods, but show extreme reverence to one particular god. You know, the Roman historian Varro says that in the first century before the Common Era, the Romans had in excess of 30,000 gods. Everyone has his own little idol, you know. Can you imagine? It must have been a confusing world for the Romans. And they had the chutzpah to call the Jews lazy for taking one day a week off. They had 157 holidays a year. Can you imagine 30,000 gods and you Jews, you have one invisible one? You're out of your mind. You know, in Rome, you know what the crime was? Any Roman who converted to Judaism, you know what they were accused of? Tried as an atheist. Because belief in one invisible God is belief in no God at all. And atheism was never allowed in the ancient world. Only modern times. So here's the little Jewish people. 2,000 years, we're saying one God. We're willing to die for that belief. That's the story of Hanukkah. And then what happens? After Abraham discovering one God and dedicating himself, which is probably a mini but incredibly profound revolution, 2,000 years later you have the second and certainly one of the most significant revolutions in consciousness in human history, which is what? The birth of Christianity and then the birth of Islam. Which is tens of millions of people over the space of a number of centuries being changed from amoral polytheists to monotheists who believe in one God and absolute morality. Any Christian or Muslim will tell you there's one God, he created the universe, there's one standard of morality, he gave the Jewish people Torah at Mount Sinai, and then he changed his mind and chose us. That's a lot closer to our position than for the 2,000 years before. Huge revolution in the way people thought. And then you have, by the way, what's the biggest interesting? The biggest spreader, because people always ask, how about, you know, places where monotheism didn't come to, like the East? Jewish ideas have spread throughout the entire world. Granted, they've spread to places that are Christian or Muslim have definitely been affected more. But Jewish ideas have reached the whole rest of the world. It's interesting how, in the modern history, what is the greatest purveyor of Jewish ideas to the world? It's interesting. It's not a religious institution. Liberal democracy, which is the most potent political force of the last 200 years, is the greatest purveyor of Jewish ideas in the world. Because liberal democracy overwhelmingly is based on Judaism. And of course, some Enlightenment thinkers, of course, like John Locke, people like that. But all the founding fathers, I did a lot of research, it's fascinating. The founding fathers of English democracy and American democracy and the Pilgrims and all these guys who signed the Declaration of Independence were all fueled by the Bible. And the image God made in man made in God's image, etc. You can see, look in the Declaration of Independence of the United States. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. They are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Amongst them are the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. One of the most fundamental statements of American political thought is the idea that there is one God who gives human beings such things like the right to life. Everyone says it. You look at just the last quote. Look at Franklin Delano Roosevelt, quote 33, in a radio broadcast, 1935. We cannot read the history of our rise and development as a nation without reckoning the place the Bible has occupied in shaping the advances of the Republic. Where we have been truest and most consistent in obeying its precepts, we have attained the greatest measure of contentment and prosperity. Okay, so just to end on a little more of a philosophical note, and I hope you enjoyed the information, but the question is what to do with it. So number one point I always make, so many Jews go through their lives thinking Judaism is irrelevant, it's got nothing to teach, it's outmoded. We have to realize nothing could be farther from the truth. We have to have Jewish pride. Now, pride is a dangerous word, it doesn't mean arrogance. Pride, we say, is justifiable self-respect at specifically the proven power of the Jewish people and Jewish ideas to change the world. It's a fact of history. We should take tremendous pride in that. The whole world is a radically different place, like Paul Johnson says, because of the Jews. It's impossible to imagine, he says, how the world would have fared if they had never emerged. Tremendous. But on a more basic level, there's a few points that are very important to focus on. You know, although the world buys into this mission, the world is not perfect. We always complain about the world today. Believe me, if I could beam everyone back for 1 hour to the ancient world, no one would ever complain about this world. Okay, as we saw from some of the examples. But what are we supposed to do with the information on a personal level? You know, the idea of perfecting the world is a pretty daunting task. So you have to understand just a couple of things. Judaism says, first and foremost, the job of perfecting the world is the collective responsibility of the Jewish people. And not only that, every human being is a unique creation made in the image of God. Okay, I once saw a very interesting poster of a really ugly little kid, a face only a mother could love. Underneath the picture was a caption, "I know I'm not junk because God doesn't make junk." Not a Jewish quote from the Talmud, but a very Jewish idea. No one is a tourist. We're not coasting through this world just observing. Every person has a role to play in contributing in some way towards making the world a better place and actualizing this mission. Ah, but how do you do that? How do you actualize your potential? That's number two point. We say, you know, a human being is far more complicated than any machine in the world. You know, you buy a computer, you buy a car, you get a big manual. You know, the computer manual you stick under the monitor so it's at a better height, you never read it. So we say God, the creator of all humanity, gave us a book. He gave us Torah. It's instructions for living. It's the guidebook for how to maximize our potential as individuals and as a nation so we can bring out in us our ability to influence the world and make it a better place in the best way possible. And we always say in Eishet Torah, you can't represent the Jewish people till you know what the Jewish people represent. The greatest danger to the Jewish people is ignorance. You have to be educated, number two. Ah, and then what do the Jewish people represent? When you study Torah, it's very clear. You see, despite the fact that Jews volunteer for causes more than any other people in human history, we don't represent a nation of people who volunteer for causes. We represent a nation of people who stand for ideas and values. And this is what we're supposed to be, a people who teach the world values. Because there's no question, if you think about it, if we got the whole world to pay more than just lip service to these values, you wouldn't need all the causes because all the problems would disappear. See, that's what we stand for, values, creating a society, creating individuals that exemplify values, creating a society that exemplifies values. Which brings us to the last and most important point. The job of perfecting the world, as I said previously, is the collective responsibility of all the Jewish people. There's a little Israeli folk song which says, "Kol echad hu or katan, ubiyachad or etan." Each of us is one small light, but together we shine bright. We are supposed to, each of us, by studying who we are as a people and as Jews, bring out our individual potential, come together to make a people that is a light to nations. When each of us adds our own little divine spark to the big flame, the whole world will look at it and say, "Ah, let's go learn from the Jews." And when we do that, we can certainly take this vision, which seems so far away, but then again, you look at 2,000 years ago, how different a place the world is. Look at what we've accomplished. We can certainly take this vision and make it a reality. And when we do, we'll achieve that mission that we've stood for since Abraham. And I want to end just by reading one quote, which is a nice biblical quote to end on. Look at the second to last quote, which is quote 34. This is the prophet Micha. Micha is describing what the world will be like when we as a people exemplify our values, come together and shine forth to the rest of the world as a light to nations. And the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on top of the mountains, and it shall be exalted above the hills. And people shall flow into it, and many nations shall go and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. And he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion will go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he shall judge between many people, and shall decide concerning mighty nations afar off. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. But they shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid. For the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken. Thank you.
You have been listening to Voices from Jerusalem. For a free cassette catalog, in the U.S. call toll-free 1-800-VOICES-3. Our email address is voices@aish.edu, or write to us at P.O. Box 14149, Jerusalem, Israel. Shalom from Jerusalem.